This is Audible.
The Design of Everyday Things by Donald A. Norman. Narrated by Peter Burkrot. Copyright 1988 by Donald A. Norman. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Basic Books, a member of the Perseus Books Group, and was produced in the year 2011 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Preface to the 2002 edition. Norman Doors. I just found a Norman door. It was really difficult to open. I am famous for doors that are difficult to open. Light switches that make no sense. Shower controls that are unfathomable. Almost anything that creates unnecessary problems, my correspondence report is a Norman thing. Norman doors. Norman switches. Norman shower controls. That wasn't what I had in mind when I wrote this book. I thought my ideas would stand for good design, for objects we could use easily and efficiently, with delight and fun, and without having to read complex instructions or ask for help. Sigh. All those years spent studying fundamental principles of the human mind, of memory and attention, learning, motor control, only to be remembered for bad doors. But then again, the interest shows that I made my point. Far too many items in the world are designed, constructed, and foisted upon us with no understanding or even care for how we will use them. Calling something a Norman door is recognition of the lack of attention paid by the maker to the user, which is precisely my message. I am delighted by the letters I receive, including yet more examples. I am delighted that many wonderful products now do exist, and that in numerous cases, designers have stated that the design of everyday things was required reading for their staffs. This book has succeeded. So show me more of those Norman doors, those faucets, those plastic bags of food that can be opened only by ripping them with the teeth. Show me more of those automobile radios, such as the one in my own car, with rows of tiny identical buttons that can't possibly be operated while driving. The problems sound trivial, but they can mean the difference between pleasure and frustration. The same principles that make these simple things work well or poorly apply to more complex operations, including ones in which human lives are at stake. Most accidents are attributed to human error, but in almost all cases, the human error was the direct result of poor design. The principles that guide a quality, human-centered design are not relevant just to a more pleasurable life. They can save lives. The Hidden Frustrations of Everyday Things. Before I wrote this book, I was a cognitive scientist, interested in how the mind works. I studied human perception, memory, and attention. I examined how people learned, how they performed skilled activities. Along the way, I became interested in human error, hoping that my understanding of error would provide ways to teach people how to avoid mistakes. But then came the nuclear power plant accident at Three Mile Island in the United States, and I was among a group of social and behavioral scientists who were called in to determine why the control room operators had made such terrible mistakes. To my surprise, we concluded that they were not to blame. The fault lay in the design of the control room. Indeed, the control panels of many power plants looked as if they were deliberately designed to cause errors. My interest in accidents led me to the study of human-centered development procedures that might eliminate those problems. I spent a sabbatical year in Cambridge, England, at the Medical Research Council's world-famous Applied Psychology Unit, and was continually amused and frustrated by the workings of the building. It was difficult to figure out which light switch controlled what light. Doors were another puzzle. Some had to be pushed, some pulled, and at least one required sliding. Yet there were no clues to the unwitting person attempting to go through the doorway. Water taps, faucets in the United States, were capricious. Some sinks had the hot water on the left, some on the right. Moreover, whenever people made errors using these ill-constructed devices, they blamed themselves. What was going on? Why did people blame themselves when a device itself was at fault? I started to observe how people coped with the numerous devices that populate our lives. In more recent years, my studies have expanded to include aviation safety, complex manufacturing plants, medical error, and a wide range of consumer products such as home entertainment systems and computers. In all these situations, people often find themselves flustered and confused. Worse, serious accidents are frequently blamed on human error. Yet careful analysis of such situations shows that the design or installation of the equipment has contributed significantly to the problems. The design team or installers did not pay sufficient attention to the needs of those who would be using the equipment, so confusion or error was almost unavoidable. Whether kitchen, stove, or nuclear power plant, automobile or aircraft, thermostat or computer, the same problems were present. In all cases, design faults led to human error. My frustrations while in England caused me to write The Design of Everyday Things, but the problems I encountered there are universal and worldwide. When I wrote the book, I was a research scientist interested in principles of cognition, but I found myself more and more fascinated by the way these principles could be applied to improve everyday life, to minimize error and accident. I changed the direction of my research to focus on applications and design. Eventually, I left my university so I could devote myself to the development of products. I joined Apple Computer, first as an Apple Fellow, then as Vice President of the Advanced Technology Group. I served as an executive at two other companies, and then, with my colleague Jacob Nielsen, co-founded a consulting company, the Nielsen-Norman Group, to apply these ideas to a wider variety of firms, a wider variety of products. It has been exciting to witness the principles in everyday things realized in products. The book title, A Lesson in Design. This book has been published under two titles. The first title, The Psychology of Everyday Things, P-O-E-T, or Poet, was much liked by my academic friends. The second title, The Design of Everyday Things, D-O-E-T, or Do It, was more meaningful and better conveyed the contents of the book. The editor of the paperback edition explained to me that in bookstores, titles are what readers see as their eyes wander the shelves, skimming the spines. They rely upon the title to describe the book. I also learned that the word psychology caused the book to be shelved in the psychology sections of the stores, which drew readers who cared about people and human relationships rather than objects and our relationships to them. Readers interested in design would never think of looking in the psychology section. I went to bookstores and watched how people browsed. I talked with book buyers and clerks. My editor was correct. I needed to change the word psychology to design. In titling my book, I had been guilty of the same short-sightedness that leads to all those unusable everyday things. My first choice of title was that of a self-centered designer, choosing the solution that pleased me without considering its impact upon readers. So Do It it became, and Do It it remains in this new edition. Lessons from Do It. When you have trouble with things, whether it's figuring out whether to push or pull a door, or the arbitrary vagaries of the modern computer and electronics industry, it's not your fault. Don't blame yourself. Blame the designer. It's the fault of the technology, or more precisely, of the design. When we first see an object we have never seen before, how do we know how to use it? How do we manage tens of thousands of objects, many of which we encounter only once? This question propelled the writing of Do It. The answer, I quickly determined, was that the appearance of the device must provide the critical clues required for its proper operation. Knowledge has to be both in the head and in the world. At the time I wrote Do It, this idea was considered strange. Today, however, the concept is more widely accepted. Many in the design community understand that design must convey the essence of a device's operation, the way it works, the possible actions that can be taken, and through feedback, just what it is doing at any particular moment. Design is really an act of communication, which means having a deep understanding of the person with whom the designer is communicating. Although Do It covers numerous topics, Three have come to stand out as critical. 1. It's not your fault. If there is anything that has caught the popular fancy, it is this simple idea. When people have trouble with something, it isn't their fault. It's the fault of the design. Every week brings yet another letter or email from someone thanking me for delivering them from their feeling of incompetence. 2. Design principles. I make it a rule never to criticize something unless I can offer a solution. Do It contains several important design principles, powerful tools for designers to ensure that their products are understandable and usable. The principles, of course, are explained within the book, but to give you a hint of what you will encounter, here is a short list of the most important. Note that they are all easy to understand, yet powerful. Conceptual models. The human mind is a wonderful organ of understanding. We are always trying to find meaning in the events around us. One of the greatest frustrations of all is trying to learn how to do something that seems completely arbitrary and capricious. Worse, when we lack understanding, we are apt to err. Consider the thermostat. When some people enter a cold house, they turn the thermostat to a very high temperature in order to reach the desired level more quickly. They do this because of their internal mental model of how the furnace works. The model is sensible and coherent, even if not well thought out. It is also wrong. But how would they know? Although this behavior is wrong for the home, it works for most automobiles. Turn the heat or air conditioning up all the way, and when the interior is at the correct temperature, adjust the temperature control again. To understand how to use things, we need conceptual models of how they work. Home furnaces, air conditioners, and even most household ovens have only two levels of operation: full power or off. Therefore, they are always heating or cooling to the desired temperature as rapidly as possible. In these cases, setting the thermostat too high does nothing but waste energy when the temperature overshoots the target. Now consider the automobile. The conceptual model is quite different. Yes, the heater and air conditioner also have only two settings, full power or off. But in many autos, the desired temperature is achieved by mixing cold and hot air. In this case, faster results come by turning off the mixing, by setting the temperature control to an extreme, until the desired temperature is reached, then adjusting the mixture to maintain the desired temperature. The explanations of the home and automobiles are examples of simple conceptual models. They are highly oversimplified, but quite adequate for understanding how they work. They make it easy for us to use very different behavior when in the home or in the auto. A good conceptual model can make the difference between successful and erroneous operation of the many devices in our lives. This short lesson on conceptual models points out that good design is also an act of communication between the designer and the user, except that all the communication has to come about by the appearance of the device itself. The device must explain itself. Even the location and operation of the controls require a conceptual model. An obvious and natural relationship between their location and the operation they control, so you always know which control does what. In the book, I call this a natural mapping. When the designers fail to provide a conceptual model, we will be forced to make up our own, and the ones we make up are apt to be wrong. Conceptual models are critical to good design. Feedback. In design, it is important to show the effect of an action. Without feedback, one is always wondering whether anything has happened. Maybe the button wasn't pushed hard enough. Maybe the machine has stopped working. Maybe it is doing the wrong thing. Without feedback, we turn equipment off at improper times or restart unnecessarily, losing all our recent work. Or we repeat the command and end up having the operation done twice, often to our detriment. Feedback is critical. Constraints. The surest way to make something easy to use with few errors is to make it impossible to do otherwise, to constrain the choices. Want to prevent people from inserting batteries or memory cards into their cameras the wrong way, thus possibly harming the electronics? Design them so that they fit only one way, or make it so they work perfectly regardless of how they were inserted. Failure to design with constraints is one reason for all those warnings and attempts to give instructions, all those tiny diagrams on the camera in obscure locations, often in the same color as the case and unreadable. I look for instructions posted on doors, cameras, and other equipment. Rule of thumb: when instructions have to be pasted on something, push here, insert this way, turn off before doing this, it is badly designed. Affordances. A good designer makes sure that appropriate actions are perceptible and inappropriate ones invisible. DeWitt introduced the concept of perceived affordances to the design community, and to my pleasure, the concept has become immensely popular. 3. The power of observation. If I have been successful, DeWitt will change the way you see the world. You will never look at a door or light switch the same way again. You will become an acute observer of people, of objects, and of the way they interact. In fact, if there is one single most important part of the book, it is this: learn to watch. Learn to observe. Observe yourself. Observe others. As the famous baseball player Yogi Berra said, you can observe a lot by watching. Problem is, you have to know how to watch. Before DeWitt, had you seen a hapless user, whether an unknown person or even yourself, you would have been apt to blame the person. Now you will find yourself critiquing the design. Better yet, you will find yourself explaining how to fix the problem. Since the design of everyday things was first published, products have become much better and much worse. Some designs are wonderful, some horrible. The number of companies that are sensitive to the needs of their customers and employ good designers increases yearly. Products have improved. Alas, at the same time, the number of companies that ignore the needs of their users and thereby create ill-conceived, unusable products seems to increase even more rapidly. The confusions foisted upon us by technology are increasing at a faster pace than ever before. Today's heavy usage of the Internet, cellular telephones, portable music players, and the wide variety of portable wireless message and email systems shows just how important these technologies have become to our lives. Nonetheless, websites are often unusable, cellular telephones grow ever more complex, and automobile dashboards look like airplane cockpits. The new products impose themselves upon us in the bedroom, in the automobile, while walking down the street. As each new technology emerges, the companies forget the lessons of the past and let engineers build their fanciful creations, driven by marketing insistence on a proliferation of features. As a result, confusion and distractions increase. Remote control of the home is a popular fantasy among technologists. Why not, they muse, call your home while you are driving and turn on the heat or air conditioner. Start filling the bathtub or make a pot of coffee. Some companies offer products that make it possible to do these things. Why do we need them? Think of how much difficulty the average automobile radio presents to the driver. Now imagine trying to control the various appliances in the home while driving. Ah, the wonders yet before us. I shudder in apprehension. Design is a complex endeavor, covering many disciplines. Engineers design bridges and dams, electronic circuits, and new forms of materials. The term design is used to refer to fashion, buildings, interior decorating, and landscaping. Many designers are artists, emphasizing aesthetics and pleasure. Others are concerned about cost. All in all, many different disciplines are involved in developing the many products we use. Although this book emphasizes one major aspect, how well the design fits the needs of the people who use it, this is only one of a multitude of dimensions that must be considered. All are important. This is what makes design such a challenging and rewarding discipline. It grapples with the need to accommodate apparently conflicting requirements. Appropriate, human-centered design requires that all the considerations be addressed from the very beginning, with each of the relevant design disciplines working together as a team. Most design is intended to be used by people, so the needs and requirements of people ought to be driving much of the work throughout the entire process. In this book, I concentrate on one component, making things that are understandable and usable. I emphasize this one dimension because it has been so long neglected. It is time to bring it to its rightful place in the development process. This does not mean that usability takes precedence over everything else. All great designs have an appropriate balance and harmony of aesthetic beauty, reliability and safety, usability, cost and functionality. There is no need to sacrifice beauty for usability, or for that matter, usability for beauty. No need to sacrifice cost or function, time to manufacture or sales. It is possible to create things that are both creative and usable, both pleasurable and completely workable. Art and beauty play essential roles in our lives. Good designs will have it all. Aesthetic pleasure, art, creativity, and at the same time be usable, workable, and enjoyable. Technology changes rapidly. People change slowly. Although significant time has passed since the writing of this book, surprisingly little needs to be changed. Why? Because the emphasis is on the people, on how we as human beings interact with the physical objects in the world. This interaction is governed by our biology, psychology, society, and culture. Human biology and psychology do not change much with time. Society and culture change very slowly. Moreover, in selecting examples, I deliberately kept away from high technology, looking instead at everyday things, things that have been around a while. High technology changes rapidly, but everyday life changes slowly. As a result, Do It has not become dated. The problems with everyday things are still there, and the principles described in Do It apply to all design, from low to high technology. Many people write to ask whether the lessons of Do It also apply to computers and other digital and wireless devices. At first, I was surprised at these questions. Of course they do. Wasn't the answer obvious? Question. In your book, The Design of Everyday Things, you talk about the design of everything from telephones to doorknobs, consisting of essentially four elements: affordance, constraint, mapping, and feedback. You weren't talking about computers, but do you think the book also applies to them? Answer. I was absolutely talking about computers. I deliberately didn't use computers and other digital devices as examples because I wanted to show that the very same principles that applied to the design of doorknobs and light switches also applied to computers, digital cameras, cell phones, nuclear power control rooms, and aircraft, and of course, vice versa. Question. Do you believe that designers of the latest technological devices address those elements? Answer. Nope. Each time a new technology comes along, new designers make the same horrible mistakes as their predecessors. Technologists are not noted for learning from the errors of the past. They look forward, not behind. So they repeat the same problems over and over again. Today's wireless devices are appalling. The principles in Do It are highly relevant. We went through this with websites. The early designs ignored all that had been learned before and set us back many years in progress toward usability and understanding. But eventually, as people became more experienced, they started to demand better websites, so things improved. As each new technology matures, customers are no longer happy with the flashy promises of the technology, but instead demand understandable and workable designs. Slowly, the manufacturers relearn the same basic principles and apply them to their products. The most egregious failures always come from the developers of the most recent technologies. One goal of Do It is to illustrate the power of design. If Do It does nothing else, it should show you how to take delight in good designs and to take umbrage at mediocre, thoughtless, inappropriate ones. Technology may change rapidly, but people change slowly. The principles, the examples, and the lessons of the design of everyday things come from an understanding of people. They remain true forever. Don Norman, Northbrook, Illinois. www.jnd.org. Preface. This is the book I have always wanted to write, but I didn't know it. Over the years, I have fumbled my way through life, walking into doors, failing to figure out water faucets, incompetent at working the simple things of everyday life. "Just me," I would mumble, "just my mechanical ineptitude." But as I studied psychology and watched the behavior of other people, I began to realize that I was not alone. My difficulties were mirrored by the problems of others, and we all seemed to blame ourselves. Could the whole world be mechanically incompetent? The truth emerged slowly. My research activities led me to the study of human error and industrial accidents. Humans, I discovered, do not always behave clumsily. Humans do not always err. But they do when the things they use are badly conceived and designed. Nonetheless, we still see human error blamed for all that befalls society. Does a commercial airliner crash? Pilot error, say the reports. Does a Soviet nuclear power plant have a serious problem? Human error, says the newspaper. Do two ships at sea collide? Human error is the official cause. But careful analysis of these kinds of incidents usually gives the lie to such a story. At the famous American nuclear power plant disaster at Three Mile Island, the blame was placed on plant operators who misdiagnosed the problems. But was it human error? Consider the phrase, "operators who misdiagnosed the problems." The phrase reveals that first there were problems, in fact a series of mechanical failures. Then why wasn't equipment failure the real cause? What about the misdiagnoses? Why didn't the operators correctly determine the cause? Well, how about the fact that the proper instruments were not available, that the plant operators acted in ways that in the past had always been reasonable and proper? How about the pressure relief valve that failed to close, even though the operator pushed the proper button, and even though a light came on stating it was closed? Why was the operator blamed for not checking two more instruments, one on the rear of the control panel, and determining that the light was faulty? Actually, the operator did check one of them. Human error? To me, it sounds like equipment failure coupled with serious design error. And yes, what about my inability to use the simple things of everyday life? I can use complicated things. I am quite expert at computers and electronics and complex laboratory equipment. Why do I have trouble with doors, light switches, and water faucets? How come I can work a multi-million-dollar computer installation but not my home refrigerator? While we all blame ourselves, the real culprit, faulty design, goes undetected. And millions of people feel themselves to be mechanically inept. It is time for a change. Hence this book, Poet, The Psychology of Everyday Things. Poet is an outgrowth of my repeated frustrations with the operation of everyday things and my growing knowledge of how to apply experimental psychology and cognitive science. The combination of experience and knowledge has made Poet necessary, at least for me and for my own feeling of ease. So here it is. Part polemic, part science. Part serious, part fun. Poet. Chapter 1. The Psychopathology of Everyday Things. Kenneth Olson, the engineer who founded and still runs Digital Equipment Corp, confessed at the annual meeting that he can't figure out how to heat a cup of coffee in the company's microwave oven. "You would need an engineering degree to figure this out. You would need an engineering degree from MIT to work this," someone once told me, shaking his head in puzzlement over his brand new digital watch. Well, I have an engineering degree from MIT. Kenneth Olson has two of them, and he can't figure out a microwave oven. Give me a few hours and I can figure out the watch. But why should it take a few hours? I have talked with many people who can't use all the features of their washing machines or cameras, who can't figure out how to work a sewing machine or a video cassette recorder, who habitually turn on the wrong stove burner. Why do we put up with the frustrations of everyday objects, with objects that we can't figure out how to use, with those neat plastic-wrapped packages that seem impossible to open, with doors that trap people, with washing machines and dryers that have become too confusing to use, with audio, stereo, television, video, cassette recorders that claim in their advertisements to do everything, but that make it almost impossible to do anything? The human mind is exquisitely tailored to make sense of the world. Give it the slightest clue and off it goes, providing explanation, rationalization, understanding. Consider the objects, books, radios, kitchen appliances, office machines, and light switches that make up our everyday lives. Well-designed objects are easy to interpret and understand. They contain visible clues to their operation. Poorly designed objects can be difficult and frustrating to use. They provide no clues, or sometimes false clues. They trap the user and thwart the normal process of interpretation and understanding. Alas, poor design predominates. The result is a world filled with frustration, with objects that cannot be understood, with devices that lead to error. This book is an attempt to change things. The frustrations of everyday life. If I were placed in the cockpit of a modern jet airliner, my inability to perform gracefully and smoothly would neither surprise nor bother me. But I shouldn't have trouble with doors and switches, water faucets and stoves. Doors, I can hear the reader saying. You have trouble opening doors? Yes. I push doors that are meant to be pulled, pull doors that should be pushed, and walk into doors that should be slid. Moreover, I see others having the same troubles, unnecessary troubles. There are psychological principles that can be followed to make these things understandable and usable. Consider the door. There is not much you can do to a door. You can open it or shut it. Suppose you are in an office building walking down a corridor. You come to a door. In which direction does it open? Should you pull or push, on the left or the right? Maybe the door slides. If so, in which direction? I have seen doors that slide up into the ceiling. A door poses only two essential questions. In which direction does it move? On which side should one work it? The answers should be given by the design without any need for words or symbols, certainly without any need for trial and error. A friend told me of the time he got trapped in the doorway of a post office in a European city. The entrance was an imposing row of perhaps six glass swinging doors, followed immediately by a second identical row. That's a standard design. It helps reduce the airflow and thus maintain the indoor temperature of the building. My friend pushed on the side of one of the leftmost pair of outer doors. It swung inward and he entered the building. Then, before he could get to the next row of doors, he was distracted and turned around for an instant. He didn't realize it at the time, but he had moved slightly to the right. So when he came to the next door and pushed it, nothing happened. He thought, must be locked. So he pushed the side of the adjacent door. Nothing. Puzzled, my friend decided to go outside again. He turned around and pushed against the side of a door. Nothing. He pushed the adjacent door. Nothing. The door he had just entered no longer worked. He turned around once more and tried the inside doors again. Nothing. Concern, then mild panic. He was trapped. Just then, a group of people on the other side of the entranceway, to my friend's right, passed easily through both sets of doors. My friend hurried over to follow their path. How could such a thing happen? A swinging door has two sides. One contains the supporting pillar and the hinge. The other is unsupported. To open the door, you must push on the unsupported edge. If you push on the hinge side, nothing happens. In this case, the designer aimed for beauty, not utility. No distracting lines, no visible pillars, no visible hinges. So how can the ordinary user know which side to push on? While distracted, my friend had moved toward the invisible supporting pillar, so he was pushing the doors on the hinged side. No wonder nothing happened. Pretty doors. Elegant. Probably won a design prize. The door story illustrates one of the most important principles of design. Visibility. The correct parts must be visible, and they must convey the correct message. With doors that push, the designer must provide signals that naturally indicate where to push. These need not destroy the aesthetics. Put a vertical plate on the side to be pushed, nothing on the other. Or make the supporting pillars visible. The vertical plate and supporting pillars are natural signals, naturally interpreted, without any need to be conscious of them. I call the use of natural signals natural design, and elaborate on the approach throughout this book. Visibility problems come in many forms. My friend, trapped between the glass doors, suffered from a lack of clues that would indicate what part of a door should be operated. Other problems concern the mappings between what you want to do and what appears to be possible. Another topic that will be expanded upon throughout the book. Consider one type of slide projector. This projector has a single button to control whether the slide tray moves forward or backward. One button to do two things? What is the mapping? How can you figure out how to control the slides? You can't. Nothing is visible to give the slightest hint. Here is what happened to me in one of the many unfamiliar places I've lectured in during my travels as a professor. The Leitz slide projector, illustrated in Figure 1, has shown up several times in my travels. The first time, it led to a rather dramatic incident. A conscientious student was in charge of showing my slides. I started my talk and showed the first slide. When I finished with the first slide and asked for the next, the student carefully pushed the control button and watched in dismay as the track backed up, slid out of the projector, and plopped off the table onto the floor, spilling its entire contents. We had to delay the lecture 15 minutes while I struggled to reorganize the slides. It wasn't the student's fault. It was the fault of the elegant projector. With only one button to control the slide advance, how could one switch from forward to reverse? Neither of us could figure out how to make the control work. All during the lecture, the slides would sometimes go forward, sometimes backward. Afterward, we found the local technician who explained it to us. A brief push of the button, and the slide would go forward. A long push, and it would reverse. Pity the conscientious student who kept pushing it hard and long to make sure that the switch was making contact. What an elegant design. Why, it managed to do two functions with only one button. But how is a first-time user of the projector to know this? As another example, consider the beautiful Amphithéâtre Louis Laird in the Paris Sorbonne, which is filled with magnificent paintings of great figures in French intellectual history. The mural on the ceiling shows a lot of naked women floating about a man who is valiantly trying to read a book. The painting is right side up only for the lecturer. It is upside down for all the people in the audience. The room is a delight to lecture in, at least until you ask for the projection screen to be lowered. "Ah," says the professor in charge, who gestures to the technician, who runs out of the room, up a short flight of stairs and out of sight behind a solid wall. The screen comes down and stops. "No, no," shouts the professor, "a little bit more." The screen comes down again, this time too much. "No, no, no," the professor jumps up and down and gestures wildly. It's a lovely room with lovely paintings. But why can't the person who is trying to lower or raise the screen see what he is doing? New telephone systems have proven to be another excellent example of incomprehensible design. No matter where I travel, I can count upon finding a particularly bad example. When I visited Basic Books, the publishers of this book, I noticed a new telephone system. I asked people how they liked it. The question unleashed a torrent of abuse. "It doesn't have a hold function," one woman complained bitterly. The same complaint people at my university made about their rather different system. In older days, business phones always had a button labeled hold. You could push the button and hang up the phone without losing the call on your line. Then you could talk to a colleague or pick up another telephone call or even pick up the call at another phone with the same telephone number. A light on the hold button indicated when the function was in use. It was an invaluable tool for business. So why didn't the new phones at Basic Books or in my university have a hold function if it is so essential? Well, they did. Even the very instrument the woman was complaining about. But there was no easy way to discover the fact, nor to learn how to use it. I was visiting the University of Michigan, and I asked about the new system there. "Yuck," was the response, "and it doesn't even have a hold function." Here we go again. What is going on? The answer is simple. First, look at the instructions for hold. At the University of Michigan, the phone company provided a little plate that fits over the keypad and reminds users of the functions and how to use them. I carefully unhooked one of the plates from the telephone and made a photocopy. See Figure 2. Can you understand how to use it? I can't. There is a call-hold operation, but it doesn't make sense to me, not for the application that I just described. The telephone hold situation illustrates a number of different problems. One of them is simply poor instructions. especially a failure to relate the new functions to the similarly named functions that people already know about. Second, and more serious, is the lack of visibility of the operation of the system. The new telephones, for all their added sophistication, lack both the hold button and the flashing light of the old ones. The hold is signified by an arbitrary action, dialing an arbitrary sequence of digits, star 8 or star 99 or what have you. It varies from one phone system to another. Third, there is no visible outcome of the operation. Devices in the home have developed some related problems. Functions and more functions. Controls and more controls. I do not think that simple home appliances, stoves, washing machines, audio and television sets, should look like Hollywood's idea of a spaceship control room. They already do, much to the consternation of the consumer, who often as not has lost or cannot understand the instruction manual. So, faced with the bewildering array of controls and displays, simply memorizes one or two fixed settings to approximate what is desired. The whole purpose of the design is lost. In England, I visited a home with a fancy new Italian washer-dryer combination, with super-duper multi-symbol controls, all to do everything you ever wanted to do with the washing and drying of clothes. The husband, an engineering psychologist, said he refused to go near it. The wife, a physician, said she had simply memorized one setting and tried to ignore the rest. Someone went to a lot of trouble to create that design. I read the instruction manual. That machine took into account everything about today's wide variety of synthetic and natural fabrics. The designers worked hard. They really cared. But obviously they had never thought of trying it out or of watching anyone use it. If the design was so bad, if the controls were so unusable, why did the couple purchase it? If people keep buying poorly designed products, manufacturers and designers will think they're doing the right thing and continue as usual. The user needs help. Just the right things have to be visible, to indicate what parts operate and how, to indicate how the user is to interact with the device. Visibility indicates the mapping between intended actions and actual operations. Visibility indicates crucial distinctions, so that you can tell salt and pepper shakers apart, for example. And visibility of the effects of the operations tells you if the lights have turned on properly, if the projection screen has lowered to the correct height, or if the refrigerator temperature is adjusted correctly. It is a lack of visibility that makes so many computer-controlled devices so difficult to operate, and it is an excess of visibility that makes the gadget-ridden, feature-laden modern audio set or video cassette recorder, VCR, so intimidating. The Psychology of Everyday Things. This book is about the psychology of everyday things. Poet emphasizes the understanding of everyday things. Things with knobs and dials, controls and switches, lights and meters. The instances we have just examined demonstrate several principles, including the importance of visibility, appropriate clues, and feedback of one's actions. These principles constitute a form of psychology. The psychology of how people interact with things. A British designer once noted that the kinds of materials used in the construction of passenger shelters affected the way vandals responded. He suggested that there might be a psychology of materials. Affordances. In one case, the reinforced glass used to panel shelters for railroad passengers, erected by British Rail, was smashed by vandals as fast as it was renewed. When the reinforced glass was replaced by plywood boarding, however, little further damage occurred, although no extra force would have been required to produce it. Thus, British Rail managed to elevate the desire for defacement to those who could write, albeit in somewhat limited terms. Nobody has as yet considered whether there is a kind of psychology of materials. But on the evidence, there could well be. There already exists the start of a psychology of materials and of things, the study of affordances of objects. When used in this sense, the term affordance refers to the perceived and actual properties of the thing, primarily those fundamental properties that determine just how the thing could possibly be used. A chair affords, is for, support, and therefore affords sitting. A chair can also be carried. Glass is for seeing through and for breaking. Wood is normally used for solidity, opacity, support, or carving. Flat, porous, smooth surfaces are for writing on. So wood is also for writing on. Hence the problem for British Rail. When the shelters had glass, vandals smashed it. When they had plywood, vandals wrote on and carved it. The planners were trapped by the affordances of their materials. Affordances provide strong clues to the operations of things. Plates are for pushing. Knobs are for turning. Slots are for inserting things into. Balls are for throwing or bouncing. When affordances are taken advantage of, the user knows what to do just by looking. No picture, label, or instruction is required. Complex things may require explanation, but simple things should not. When simple things need pictures, labels, or instructions, the design has failed. A psychology of causality is also at work as we use everyday things. Something that happens right after an action appears to be caused by that action. Touch a computer terminal just when it fails, and you are apt to believe that you caused the failure, even though the failure and your action were related only by coincidence. Such false causality is the basis for much superstition. Many of the peculiar behaviors of people using computer systems or complex household appliances result from such false coincidences. When an action has no apparent result, you may conclude that the action was ineffective, so you repeat it. In earlier days, when computer word processors did not always show the results of their operations, people would sometimes attempt to change their manuscript, but the lack of visible effect from each action would make them think that their commands had not been executed, so they would repeat the commands, sometimes over and over, to their later astonishment and regret. It is a poor design that allows either kind of false causality to occur. 20,000 Everyday Things. There are an amazing number of everyday things, perhaps 20,000 of them. Are there really that many? Start by looking about you. There are light fixtures, bulbs and sockets, wall plates and screws, clocks, watches and watch bands. There are writing devices. I could count 12 in front of me, each different in function, color, or style. There are clothes with different functions, openings, and flaps. Notice the variety of materials and pieces. Notice the variety of fasteners, buttons, zippers, snaps, laces. Look at all the furniture and food utensils. All those details, each serving some function for manufacturability, usage, or appearance. Consider the work area. Paper clips, scissors, pads of paper, magazines, books, bookmarks. In the room I'm working in, I counted more than 100 specialized objects before I tired. Each is simple, but each requires its own method of operation. Each has to be learned, each does its own specialized task, and each has to be designed separately. Furthermore, many of the objects are made of many parts. A desk stapler has 16 parts, a household iron 15. The simple bathtub-shower combination, 23. You can't believe these simple objects have so many parts. Here are the 11 basic parts to a sink. Drain, flange, around the drain, pop-up stopper, basin, soap dish, overflow vent, spout, lift rod, fittings, hot water handle, and cold water handle. We can count even more if we start taking the faucets, fittings, and lift rods apart. The book, What's What? A Visual Glossary of the Physical World, has more than 1,500 drawings and pictures and illustrates 23,000 items, or parts of items. Irving Biederman, a psychologist who studies visual perception, estimates that there are probably 30,000 readily discriminable objects for the adult. Whatever the exact number, it is clear that the difficulties of everyday life are amplified by the sheer profusion of items. Suppose that each everyday thing takes only 1 minute to learn. Learning 20,000 of them occupies 20,000 minutes, 333 hours, or about 8 40-hour work weeks. Furthermore, we often encounter new objects unexpectedly when we are really concerned with something else. We are confused and distracted, and what ought to be a simple, effortless, everyday thing interferes with the important task of the moment. How do people cope? Part of the answer lies in the way the mind works, in the psychology of human thought and cognition. Part lies in the information available from the appearance of the objects, the psychology of everyday things. And part comes from the ability of the designer to make the operation clear, to project a good image of the operation, and to take advantage of other things people might be expected to know. Here is where the designer's knowledge of the psychology of people, coupled with knowledge of how things work, becomes crucial. Conceptual models. Consider the rather strange bicycle illustrated in Figure 3. You know it won't work because you form a conceptual model of the device and mentally simulate its operation. You can do the simulation because the parts are visible and the implications clear. Other clues to how things work come from their visible structure, in particular from affordances, constraints, and mappings. Consider a pair of scissors. Even if you have never seen or used them before, you can see that the number of possible actions is limited. The holes are clearly there to put something into, and the only logical things that will fit are fingers. The holes are affordances. They allow the fingers to be inserted. The size of the holes provide constraints to limit the possible fingers. The big hole suggests several fingers, the small hole only one. The mapping between holes and fingers, the set of possible operations, is suggested and constrained by the holes. Moreover, the operation is not sensitive to finger placement. If you use the wrong fingers, the scissors still work. You can figure out the scissors because their operating parts are visible and the implications clear. The conceptual model is made obvious, and there is effective use of affordances and constraints. As a counterexample, consider the digital watch, one with 2 to 4 push buttons on the front or side. What are those push buttons for? How would you set the time? There is no way to tell. No evident relationship between the operating controls and the functions. No constraints, no apparent mappings. With the scissors, moving the handle makes the blades move. The watch and the Leech slide projector provide no visible relationship between the buttons and the possible actions. No discernible relationship between the actions and the end result. Principles of design for understandability and usability. We have now encountered the fundamental principles of designing for people. 1. Provide a good conceptual model, and 2. Make things visible. Provide a good conceptual model. A good conceptual model allows us to predict the effects of our actions. Without a good model, we operate by rote, blindly. We do operations as we were told to do them. We can't fully appreciate why, what effects to expect, or what to do if things go wrong. As long as things work properly, we can manage. When things go wrong, however, or when we come upon a novel situation, then we need a deeper understanding, a good model. For everyday things, conceptual models need not be very complex. After all, scissors, pens, and light switches are pretty simple devices. There is no need to understand the underlying physics or chemistry of each device we own, simply the relationship between the controls and the outcomes. When the model presented to us is inadequate or wrong, or worse, non-existent, we can have difficulties. Let me tell you about my refrigerator. My house has an ordinary 2-compartment refrigerator. Nothing very fancy about it. The problem is that I can't set the temperature properly. There are only 2 things to do: adjust the temperature of the freezer compartment and adjust the temperature of the fresh food compartment. And there are 2 controls, one labeled freezer, the other fresh food. What's the problem? You try it. Figure 4 shows the instruction plate from inside the refrigerator. Now suppose the freezer is too cold, the fresh food section just right. You want to make the freezer warmer, keeping the fresh food constant. Go on, read the instructions. Figure them out. Oh, perhaps I'd better warn you. The 2 controls are not independent. The freezer control affects the fresh food temperature, and the fresh food control affects the freezer. And don't forget to wait 24 hours to check on whether you made the right adjustment, if you can remember what you did. Control of the refrigerator is made difficult because the manufacturer provides a false conceptual model. There are 2 compartments and 2 controls. The setup clearly and unambiguously provides a simple model for the user. Each control is responsible for the temperature of the compartment that carries its name. Wrong. In fact, there is only 1 thermostat and only 1 cooling mechanism. One control adjusts the thermostat setting, the other the relative proportion of cold air sent to each of the two compartments of the refrigerator. This is why the two controls interact. With the conceptual model provided by the manufacturer, adjusting the temperatures is almost impossible and always frustrating. Given the correct model, life would be much easier. See Figure 5. Why did the manufacturer present the wrong conceptual model? Perhaps the designers thought the correct model was too complex, that the model they were giving was easier to understand. But with the wrong conceptual model, it is impossible to set the controls. And even though I am convinced I now know the correct model, I still cannot accurately adjust the temperatures, because the refrigerator design makes it impossible for me to discover which control is for the thermostat, which control is for the relative proportion of cold air, and in which compartment the thermostat is located. The lack of immediate feedback for the actions does not help. With a delay of 24 hours, who can remember what was tried? The topic of conceptual models will reappear in the book. They are part of an important concept in design. Mental models. The models people have of themselves, others, the environment, and the things with which they interact. People form mental models through experience, training, and instruction. The mental model of a device is formed largely by interpreting its perceived actions and its visible structure. I call the visible part of the device the system image, referred to Figure 6. When the system image is incoherent or inappropriate, as in the case of the refrigerator, then the user cannot easily use the device. If it is incomplete or contradictory, there will be trouble. Make things visible. The problems caused by inadequate attention to visibility are all neatly demonstrated with one simple appliance, the modern telephone. I stand at the blackboard in my office, talking with a student, when my telephone rings. Once, twice, it rings. I pause, trying to complete my sentence before answering. The ringing stops. "I'm sorry," says the student. "Not your fault," I say. "But it's no problem. The call now transfers to my secretary's phone. She'll answer it." As we listen, we hear her phone start to ring. Once, twice. I look at my watch. 6 o'clock. It's late. The office staff has left for the day. I rush out of my office to my secretary's phone, but as I get there, it stops ringing. Ah, I think. It's being transferred to another phone. Sure enough, the phone in the adjacent office now starts ringing. I rush to that office, but it is locked. Back to my office to get the key, out to the locked door, fumble with the lock, into the office, and to the now quiet phone. I hear a telephone down the hall start to ring. Could that still be my call, making its way mysteriously with a predetermined lurching path through the phones of the building? Or is it just another telephone call coincidentally arriving at this time? In fact, I could have retrieved the call from my office had I acted quickly enough. The manual states, "Within your pre-programmed pickup group, dial 14 to connect to incoming call. Otherwise, to answer any ringing extension, dial ringing extension number, listen for busy tone. Dial 8 to connect to incoming call." Huh? What do those instructions mean? What is a pre-programmed pickup group, and why do I even want to know? What is the extension number of the ringing phone? Can I remember all those instructions when I need them? No. Telephone chase is the new game in the modern office, as the automatic features of telephones go awry. Features designed without proper thought, and certainly without testing them with their intended users. There are several other games, too. One game is announced by the plea, "How do I answer this call?" The question is properly whined in front of a ringing, flashing telephone, receiver in hand. Then there is the paradoxical game entitled, "This telephone doesn't have a hold function." The accusation is directed at a telephone that actually does have a hold function. And finally there is, "What do you mean I called you? You called me." Many of the modern telephone systems have a new feature that automatically keeps trying to dial a number for you. This feature resides under names such as automatic redialing or automatic callback. I'm supposed to use this feature whenever I call someone who doesn't answer or whose line is busy. When the person next hangs up the phone, my phone will dial it again. Several automatic callbacks can be active at a time. Here's how it works. I place a phone call. There's no answer. So I activate the automatic callback feature. Several hours later, my telephone rings. I pick it up and say hello, only to hear a ringing sound and then someone else saying hello. Hello, I answer, who is this? Who is this? I hear in reply. You called me. No, I say, you called me.